for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Robert Spector grew up cutting cold cuts in his father's butcher shop in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. He couldn't have realized then that one day he'd write about the challenges facing mom and pop shops in today's ever-changing global economy. In a new book, he recalls what he learned from working with his father and how mom and pop stores managed to survive and even thrive to this day. His book is titled The Mom and Pop Store, and Robert Spector joins me in the studio. Before we begin our conversation, I do want to thank so many people who have been so kind, sending cards, letters, flowers, dinners. It's just been perfectly lovely to know that there are so many good friends and people I don't even know personally who have been so thoughtful. It's good to be back, and I thank you all. Bob Spector, it's good to meet you, and I'll call you Robert.
Okay. Good to meet you, too, Diane. A pleasure and an honor to be here.
Thank you. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You know, I wonder in this day and age what people define as a mom and pop store.
Well, the way I look at it, when I use the term mom and pop, it's an iconic term. Everyone knows what you're talking about. But I don't mean literally in every case mom and pop. I mean mom and mom, son and daughter, life partner and life partner, same sex life partners. It's all to me mom and pop. But essentially, it's the small independent retailer that we all know, that we all have in our neighborhood, and hopefully that we all do business with.
And, of course, there is one right here that we all think of, and that's Politics and Prose.
That's right.
With Carla Cohen, who established that with her friend
Barbara Mead. Right.
And, mm-hmm. and who've made that such a powerhouse of a store, an independent bookstore.
Absolutely. Well, I interviewed Barbara and Carla for this book, and the premise of the book was I traveled around the country interviewing mom and pop stores all over the United States and even in London and in Tokyo. And Barbara and Carla at Politics and Prose, they call themselves a mom and mom store. And you're right, they have established a nationally known retail spot that every author wants to go to. In fact, I'll be there tonight. Cheap plug for myself. But what they are really is a part of the community, and the subtext of this book is community.
Well, and growing up here in Washington, just a walk away mm-hmm. was a delicatessen. Next door to it, a small dry cleaner. Next to that, a small bicycle shop. And on the corner, two blocks away, an independently owned drugstore, all of which have now been replaced.
Well, you know, I talk about the fact that, that neighborhoods change, neighbors change, ethnic makeups change, but I'm sure that those stores that are no longer there have been replaced with other things, not quite the same thing, but there's always an opportunity for somebody with a good idea. It doesn't have to be an original idea, but just a good idea to put their stamp on their individual store and make it work for the community.
You know, it's wonderful that Mayor Adrienne Fenty here in the District of Columbia has declared today, September 14th, Mom and Pop Store Day. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Well,
in fact,
really,
you know, the mayor comes from a mom and pop store. His family has a store, so I think that's something that he's very much aware of and tries to support.
Tell me about your own growing up.
Well, I grew up in Perth Amboy, New Jersey, which is across the Raritan Bay from Staten Island, New York, so just less than an hour outside of Manhattan. And mine is a typical immigrant family business story. My paternal grandfather arrived here in 1910. left four children under the age of nine. It took him 11 years to make up enough money to bring over his children. My father didn't see his father from age 3 to age 14, and he would tell the story when they arrived at Ellis Island, and his mother was with my father and his other siblings. They pointed to a man across the way. She said, "You see that man over there? That's your father."
Oh.
So they eventually got into the butcher business in a farmer's market in Perth Amboy, New Jersey. We had the only physical permanent building on the site, so we would open up our doors, garage doors, open up to the elements. It gets very cold in New Jersey in the winter and hot in the summer, and farmers would bring in their wares and sell fruits and vegetables, chickens, usually alive at the time, and there'd be craftspeople, just a typical market. And I started working there full-time the week after my bar mitzvah at age 13, and I was the baby of my family, the last one to work there. Cousins and my sisters and uncles worked there, and I hated working in my father's store, absolutely despised it. I was the worst worker of anyone in my family. So the great irony that I wrote this book, you know, I tell people my father was a smart man, not an educated man. He couldn't define ironic for you, but if he came back and you told him Robert wrote a book about the market, he would immediately get ironic.
What did you hate about it, so?
Well, it was not you had to slice different cold cuts and put your hands in all the chopped meat, and I had to sweep the floors. I had to we had a little area where I had to get water, literally a bucket of water, to wash things off. And this was where the winos in Perth Amboy would spend their evenings. So it didn't have the most fragrant smell one had ever had. So I had to do that. But just, it was Saturday. I wanted to be playing with my friends. I didn't want to be, doing all this.
Did your father insist that you come in after school, or was it just on Saturday?
It was mainly on Saturday and occasionally on Fridays. We had a second store in a town called South River. Now, for people in Washington, the most famous person from South River was Joe Theismann. So we'd had that on Friday, and that was in a smaller market, but we were actually we had a store with a door, and you could close it as opposed to being open to the elements. So it was long. It was not pleasant. Most of his customers were Eastern European immigrants like himself. And so the whole thing, I didn't realize till years later all the lessons I learned when I didn't think I'd been paying attention.
Robert Spector, his new book is titled The Mom and Pop Store, How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving. Do join us, 800-433-8850, and send your email to drshow@wamu.org. It's interesting that you say that even in the face of this big box economy that we are seeing, that mom and pop shops are thriving.
Well, because it's interesting now. I wrote a book a few years ago called Category Killers about big box stores for Harvard Business School Press. So this is kind of the yin to the yang of that. And I actually finished up that book looking at independent stores that figure out how to survive. And essentially, in order to survive, you have to adapt to change, because as a change is constant, ethnic groups change, the market changes. So a lot of the retailers who I met along the way adapted to those changes. Some radically altered their business. They expanded to the internet. I don't take a romantic view of this, Diane, because I write about business. So you have to have a reason for being. Just because you're a mom and pop store doesn't make you special. You have to figure out a way to be special. And the stores that I wrote about, and I covered stores all over the United States, meat markets and bookstores and jewelry stores and coffee shops, they all figured out a way to stay relevant. And that's what you have to do. I speak a lot to small businesses, and I say, if you want to be a specialty retailer, you have to be special.
What does that mean?
Well, it depends on each individual thing. I think back on what my father did in this rather, you know, modest little market, but he carried ethnic specialty foods for his clientele that they couldn't get at the AMP, which was literally around the corner. And he had a great sense of humor, and he could literally speak their language. He spoke three or four languages, and we had this one customer named Mrs. Tresky who always got a ride home on Saturday.
Huh.
And she actually worked in the market. She made doilies and handkerchiefs. And she'd come toward the end of the day when it wasn't too busy, and she'd buy her provisions for the week. And now she had these heavy bags full to overflowing. And my father didn't want to let Mrs. Tresky take the bus, so he would throw me the keys to the car, and he said, "Robert, drive Mrs. Tresky home." And, you know, it was that kind of thing. I mean, this was not brain surgery. This is just very simple stuff about taking care of the customer. And all the people who survive and thrive today in mom-and-pop stores, they figure out a way to take care of the customer.
There are different ethnic groups mm-hmm. now who are bringing these shops into light and offering not only their specialties, but working so hard.
Well, that's, you know, the mom and pop store has always been an entryway for ethnic people. Excuse me, because it's labor intensive, and it gives the family members an opportunity to make a living.
And that's exactly how they begin and begin to thrive. The book we're talking about is The Mom and Pop Store. I know you've got stories to share with us. I look forward to hearing from you. And welcome back. We're talking about something that I think is familiar to most of us, a book titled The Mom and Pop Store. Every one of us who's grown up in any area has seen these kinds of stores. They may not necessarily be run by a mom and a pop, but they are small stores that offer the kind of specialties needed to keep them viable, vibrant, and working hard. We were talking during the break, Robert Spector, about some of the people you've talked to, many of whom were Koreans. Tell us why, and tell us how they manage.
Well, I really covered various ethnic groups, from Japanese to Greeks to Germans. You know, it really doesn't matter. You know, the whole thing about, you know, immigrants, when they come to this country, they all figure out, not, I shouldn't say all, but they understand what it takes to survive. And that's why, as I said before, mom-and-pop stores or independent retailers are a great source of being an entryway into this country, because it is labor-intensive. It employs a lot of people in the family. And In a lot of cases, immigrants are willing to work harder than native-born Americans are. I talked to my editor about not only immigrants, but also people who have dropped out of the corporate world and decided that rather than trading hedge funds, they'll use grandma's cupcake recipe and open up a little store. So my editor asked me, what's the difference between those people, and immigrants? And I said, well, those people have dropped out of the corporate world who are educated are looking for meaning. My family and other immigrants were looking for means.
Of course, yeah, just so, absolute basic means.
Survival.
And you talked about Koreans as coming from a country surrounded, coming from an area where they knew they had to protect themselves. And many of these Koreans have developed very successful stores.
Right, whether it's dry cleaners or green good grocers, you go all over Manhattan, and a good many of the grocers are owned by Koreans. As I told you off the air, I have an adopted Korean daughter, and I'm going to Korea in a couple of months. And because they're surrounded by Russia and Japan and China, they develop a certain feistiness and an appetite for survival, and that translates into any kind of business. If you're willing to work hard, if you're willing to do whatever it takes to get the job done, and of course you have to have the right location and all that other stuff, but working hard and doing whatever it takes transcends any ethnic group, any racial group. It's very basic.
You know, when my dad first came here to this country in 1907, he and his brothers established a small grocery store. Mm-hmm. And when I was a little girl, I said, "Now, Dad, where do you go at 2 o'clock in the morning?" And he said, "Well, I'll take you with me one morning." And downtown we went to the market to purchase the meat, to purchase the veggies, mm-hmm. all of those things that have to stock a store starting mm-hmm. at 2 o'clock in the morning. No wonder he was so tired by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. But work hard they did.
Absolutely. Well, my father would get up at 3:30, 4:30 in the morning, and I remember him coming home because he'd come home fairly early in the mid afternoon, and he would fall asleep
in
the chair. Yes,
absolutely.
Because he was working.
Absolutely.
But one of the great things for those of us who are children of mom and pop store owners is that we get a chance to see what our parents do for a living and even help them out and participate. And as I wrote in my book, if I hadn't worked with my father, I would have missed a large portion of understanding who he was, because he was one person at home where my mother basically ran the show, and he was another person in the business where he ran the show.
But what was, in your mind, the most important lesson you learned from working in that store?
Honesty. It's all very, very basic stuff, because my father was an honest man. And I interviewed some cousins of mine who worked with my father and my grandfather. And if there was a problem if a customer had a question about the weight of a particular item, my father would invite them to come to the other side of the counter
and read the scale.
Yeah, that's what because there were butchers in that market who would pull down on the paper and maybe make it another half ounce or so. You didn't do that. And the thing about owning an independent business is that you can't hide behind a corporation. You are it. You are, it's only as good as your word and your honesty. And if you are not honest, word will get out. So having a good name is really the most important thing, and having integrity. Again,
and
very simple.
Also, having the independence to make the decisions that you want to make regarding the community you live in and how you interact.
Right. You know, the difference between the mom-and-pop stores and the corporations is that the people who run mom-and-pop stores have to be a little bit of everything. They're the chief executive officer, the chief operating officer. They're the buyer, the merchandiser, the human resource person. I contend it's harder to run a mom-and-pop store than it is a Fortune 500 company. You need more talents.
Do you think that we have reached a point in our society where perhaps to a certain extent people are once again yearning for that individual interaction with one store owner?
Absolutely. I think because what we've gone through in the past few years, our faith in our financial institutions has been shaken. Our faith in politics and government in many ways has been shaken. So what we have are the people who we see every day, our neighbors, the people who are part of our community. That's why there's such a big buy local movement going on and people talking about keeping the money in the community. And when I was looking for the hook for this book, Diane, because it's different than any other book I've written because it's memoir, first book I've written in the first person. So I'm thinking, what is the hook? You know, where does this all come through? So I was researching my paternal grandfather who settled in Newark, New Jersey, and I was in the New Jersey Information Center in the public library in downtown Newark, and I was researching some other businesses that he had been in. He had a honey business and a couple other things. So I'm looking on microfiche at the 1930 Newark, New Jersey City Directory. The publisher lists all the reasons why you should buy this directory. It's complete. It's got all the businesses, all the churches and synagogues, etc. And then in italics at the bottom, it says, if your neighbor has it to sell, give him your business. Like consideration from your neighbor adds prosperity to both. And I looked at that.
Perfect.
That's the hook. You've
Perfect.
Got something, I'll buy from you, and vice versa, and that's what makes the world go around. That's what this book is about.
But in the meantime, we have seen this onslaught of the big box stores. Mm-hmm. So to what extent, put it another way, what does it take to retain that kind of not only independence and honesty and hard work, but what does it take to keep that small store going in the face of that big box competition?
Very simple. Give them your business. You know, when we hear about, you know, stores that have been, you know, pushed out because of Walmart and any of the big box stores, no one is putting a gun to the head of people to buy at the big box stores. So, you know, it's like from the old...
If it's more expensive to buy at the mom and pop stores, why not go to the big box stores?
Well, it's taking a very short-term view of what, because eventually you are paying, more or the same, because the idea of keeping the money in the community, you know, so If I buy something at XYZ big box store, part of that, a good portion of that money is going out of my neighborhood. But if I give it to somebody who I know, then it stays in the neighborhood. And also you're going to need those stores. So if you want those stores to be there when you need them, you have to support them. So don't take a short-term view that, oh, I can save 50 cents or I can save a dollar. I understand, you know, times are tough and people have to do that. But we still need to keep that within the neighborhood, within the community.
But isn't the big box store paying taxes in that small community just as the small store is paying taxes?
Yeah, absolutely. But they might have gotten a tax break from you know,
for coming in.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things I wanted to make sure that I remember to talk about. And that's the role of local and state politicians in terms of these kinds of stores. Now, as you know, it's great. You know, politician loves to have a big ribbon cutting ceremony for a large store that, you know, they just brought 300 new jobs to our town. Now, that's a lot more interesting and sexier than doing it 100 times with 3 new employees around. But it's still the same thing of having 300 new jobs, but it's done in smaller increments.
The other problem is that We talked earlier today about poverty. We mm-hmm. talked about health insurance. We talked about the obligations placed upon small employers. Now, your father did not have to worry about paying your health care in addition to paying everything else. But these days, small employers are faced with those additional expenses.
Right, absolutely. It's that's one of the reasons that some stores keep the number of employees down.
Down.
Because they can't afford to have any more. So, you know, I would like to see our political leaders do things in a positive way for those small independent businesses and figure out a way to make life easier for them so they can hire more people and help get the economy going. The economy is not going to come back from hiring by the large corporations. They're obviously laying off people. They're keeping things down. We need to have another engine of the economy, and I submit it's the small independent businesses.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I want to hear about the AA Jewel Box in Orange County, California.
Well, I found out about them from a colleague of mine who works in that part of Orange County, and I was looking for an Asian American family, and he told me, "Oh, you need to go to the AA Jewel Box." So I went there. It's a 3-generation family. The founder was interred in the detention camps during World War II with many other Japanese Americans. He eventually was able to join the armed services.
You mean interned?
Interned, right.
Not interred.
I'm
he
sorry.
Yes.
Thank you for correcting
You're
me.
You're welcome.
Yes, and he eventually served in the military and got out and got into. He learned how to repair watches, and then eventually got into the jewelry business. Now it's a third generation business, and the young son, who's in his 30s, is running it now, and they are such an integral part of the community. And I asked them, especially the mother of the second generation, tell me other things where you have a connection to your community. And she said, well, we have, these are not only our customers, they're our friends. She said, we had this one longtime customer who was in the hospital, and she was dying. Her fingers were swollen. She couldn't keep her wedding band on.
Oh.
So the owner of the AA Jewel Box, Alan Yasugi, went to the hospital room, got her wedding band, took it to Los Angeles to get it resized, brought it back to her so she could pass away with her wedding band on. So it's a lot more than just the exchange of goods and services for money. It's being a part of the community, being a friend in need.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people on the phone who have been feeling the same way. Let's go first to Mila in Berlin, Germany.
Wow!
Good morning, Mila. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. I've never called into a national talk show from America. This is cool.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, I also come from a family that had a small business. We made quilts, art, and we sold them at the art shows in the Midwest. And this is something that I find is really interesting because Germany doesn't really have these types of big art shows. I don't know if you have them in the East Coast.
Yes, I think we do have, and especially quilt shows.
You have quilt shows?
Yeah.
The Amish.
Right. Well, but more than just the Amish, I mean, an awful lot of people in this country are into quilts these days.
Yeah, that's cool. But, you know, that's the whole thing with the big box stores. If the price of the items in the big box stores reflected the fact that little children are making those items all day long in factories where they can't even go to the bathroom, and some of the people die of not being able to go to the bathroom.
All right, Mila, thanks for your call. I think she has a point that in some cases, because the same kind of regulations that we have in this country don't apply. In other countries, you may be buying merchandise that has not been up to our standards.
Right. Well, that's certainly an important issue, and I think that when we go to stores, we need to do a little research and look at the labels and talk to the owners and maybe get a little more background on where this merchandise came from. If we feel that there might be a question on what the other circumstances are behind that.
Of course, quite often in the big box stores, they're not sure.
And they're not asking the question.
And they're not asking the question, whereas in mom-and-pop stores, you can't say always they would know exactly, but they're more likely to be attentive to those kinds of details.
Because they've done the buying, and not a third party or not somebody somewhere else.
Robert Spector. His new book is titled The Mom and Pop Store. When we come back, we'll take calls from Cleveland, St. Louis, Chapel Hill, Columbia, Maryland, and Miami, Florida. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. By Global Nutritional Research, maker of Clotamin, a multivitamin designed for people on blood thinners, at clotamin.com. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, True Compass. Senator Edward Kennedy's memoir has been published posthumously. We talk with Kennedy's publisher and editor, Jonathan Karp, who worked with the senator in the last year of his life and got to know the man behind the public persona. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Let's go right to Cleveland, Ohio, to Elaine, who's an independent business owner. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Diane. You're like talking to a mom and pop. You've got the personal and you've got the ambience of, it's not like talking to GM.
Thank you.
I love you. I have everything going for me that Robert listed. I've been an independent retailer for 39 years in a gift shop. I do a lot of personalizing myself. I work all kinds of hours. We're able to, in the store, be open late as we want. We're able to be open holidays, Sundays, whatever. We've got that. We've got the honesty. We've got the personal contact. We've got doing things in the community and helping people out. All the things that he mentioned, we've done. Every single thing as I was listening. What I have at the problem area is what his parents didn't have years ago, the ratio of the rent, the utilities, the shipping costs, the bags, tissue, and boxes that things go into, advertising, the rates if you're going to do advertising other than word of mouth, people shopping online, and, of course, people buying some of your products at the big box stores, in which my case, they can't do that 99% of the time because we get things from cottage industries, which is another way to go, and I make a lot of things myself. You can't overcome that, and, you know, you just can't, and I just wanted to know your comments on that and maybe, you know, what your thinking on that is.
Well, let me ask you this. You said you've been doing this for
39 years.
And,
not for money, for a hobby.
Uh-huh.
It's a passion.
But you're in a building where the rent is going up.
No, I'm in a building where 5 or 6 years ago, my 1,200 feet cost $700, and it's now $2,800.
Wow.
Well, you know, I can't speak about Cleveland specifically, but I know that in a lot of cities, one of the benefits, I put in quotes, about the recession is that there is some opportunities for small independent businesses, both in shopping malls, because so many of the chain stores have closed. There, all of a sudden, there is this space in shopping malls, and landlords are more amenable to adjusting the rents. And they're doing that. I just saw an article in the New York Times about in Manhattan that, again, landlords would rather have less rent and a business in there than having a boarded up shop. So is there any indication that that the rent is going to be going down anytime soon, or is your landlord getting what he's getting and that's it?
I'm in a village. It's like the perfect USA. I've been in shopping centers. If you're going to be in a good neighborhood, when you talked about area and everything, it's not going down. It's going up. And they'd rather be empty and take their tax write-offs or whatever they do. And they also feel it sets a precedent if they let somebody in on the block. And I have a lot of different owners, maybe 20 or 30 in the village that we're in. If they let somebody, it gets around. And then everybody wants a cut. And it's just a sick game. And it's putting many, many people out. Corporations, of course, can manipulate this, but independents cannot. We are not needed, and we will not be missed. And I can tell you when you said, oh, you need these people. No, they don't need us.
I lost.
They don't need us, she says.
Well, I appreciate your position. I've traveled all over the country. I know you're in Ohio. I have a florist in Dayton, and it's in the fourth generation, and a meat market in Cincinnati that's in the fifth generation, and they figured out ways to stay relevant in the community, whether specializing in a particular ethnic food or in the case of the florist, he got into the wholesale business because he got angry at his wholesaler for ignoring him and doing business with the big box stores. So it's a constant
readjustment,
yeah. Reinvention, and it ain't easy. If it was easy, then everybody could do it.
Elaine,
I wish
you all success. Here's an email from Melissa, who says, my Lebanese grandfather originally started out as a backpack peddler after World War I. He walked over 100 miles selling out of his packs and suitcases from farmhouse to farmhouse in the Midwest. When he was out of product, walking back. He did that until he made enough money for a horse, then a truck, and then his own mom and pop shop with my grandmother. Isn't that a wonderful story?
That is a classic story. Peddling has a long and noble tradition, and you know, various ethnic groups. I mentioned in the book, every language has a word for peddler because there were peddlers in every kind of country and ethnic group, and that's a classic story. I've got a pharmacy that I write about, the New London Pharmacy on the west side of Manhattan, and the woman who runs it, Abby Fazio, her father was a Greek immigrant who sold hot dogs in Washington Square Park. And he later was able to get a permanent space in the post office, and he made enough money to buy a hotel on a Greek island.
Well, you probably know the story of Marriott, which began right here in Washington, D.C., with a small stand on Park Road, just off 14th Street, and the first hot shop I used to go to was owned by Marriott, which now owns hotels all over the world.
Right. Well, I wrote a book called The Nordstrom Way, and Nordstrom started out as a little shoe store in downtown Seattle in 1901. And look at it today.
But the question is, do you think that this can actually be done today?
Absolutely. You know, people have been writing the obituary for mom-and-pop stores for, over 100 years. I have things in my book from, like, 1904, somebody saying, well, you know, that in
that
so many
era
words,
is
it's
over.
All over. It's all over.
Yeah.
But as mom-and-pop stores have survived everything, discount stores, the internet, department stores, because people are still going to look for something unique, something that says my neighborhood is different than your neighborhood.
And something they can feel and hold on to, which is different from the internet. To St. Louis, Missouri, good morning, Dimitri.
Good morning, Diane. Even though you were replaced by very competent people, I sure missed you and hearing you.
Well, I missed you, too, and I'm happy to be back with you. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a comment to your guest. My parents were immigrants. They came over from Albania, and it was hard for my father to find work. So with four children, it was difficult for us to get by. We had a grocery store that was owned by a Jewish family. They lived over the store, and my father would go in there and say, I'm out of work, I don't have any money, but my children are hungry and we need some food. Would you extend me credit? And the owner of the store says, of course. And he says, I'll just write it down on a slip of paper. When you get back to work, you can pay me. Well, that was probably the most significant thing for my survival, because it was very difficult. You know, you couldn't get anybody during that time to share their food. But the beautiful thing about it is that there were other people in the neighborhood who would ask the owner for the same opportunity to be carried on his sheet of paper, but they wouldn't pay him.
Huh.
But he still extended them credit, and he still allowed them to have food. And there were my father and mother made sure that we always paid him, because we knew that many of the people wouldn't even pay him. So he helped us survive, and we have some very good memories of that.
That's lovely. Wonderful story.
Well, I actually write a little bit about the whole notion of credit in stores. And, you know, credit comes from the French word credere, means to believe. So we are essentially saying we believe that you're going to pay us back. My father certainly extended credit to people. I was lucky enough to interview Colin Powell for this book, and he talked about the grocery stores in his neighborhood in the South Bronx, and about how they gave credit, and at the end of the week or the end of the month, the owner of the store would total it up, and people would eventually pay it back. Did everybody pay him back? No, but it was kind of a part of a service to the community that you extend that credit.
And I think Dimitri is not alone in saying that his family wouldn't have survived without that kind of credit.
Absolutely.
Thanks for calling to Herb in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you.
Certainly.
I approach this subject matter from an entirely different direction. For the last 35 years, I've made my living designing independent jewelry stores. That's all I do, jewelry stores, and only independence. They, jewelers, I have found, don't like the word mom and expression mom and pop. They lean more toward independent. But all I do is independent stores, not chains. And we've talked a lot about why independent stores work, the personal aspect to it. But you're also, a lot of the time, dealing with the owner, which gives you more experience and more knowledge. You have somebody who has been doing this for a while and knows what they're doing and has the authority to make decisions on the spot, which makes the service obviously significantly better.
I think that's such a good point.
Oh, absolutely. You want to be waited on people who understand the product and who are motivated. You know, there's that big motivation thing going on. And I know just very briefly you mentioned that some people don't like the term mom-and-pop store. And the reason why, for a couple of reasons I use it in my title. One is I'm honoring my own mother and father in this, and also the fact that it's an iconic term. If I called it the independent retailer, it kind of takes the romance
it
out of
it. Sure does. It's very different.
But it is the same
thing. Yeah. Herb, thanks for the call. Here's another perspective from Mickey in Grand Haven, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yeah, my perspective is real simple, that a lot of the ones that I see surviving in our area, they've got their capital investments have been taken care of years ago, buildings, rent, fixtures, whatever it is that they have, equipment in some cases. And the ones that are trying to break open now, you know, they have all of this to overcome in today's market. I find it a lot more, and I've owned several businesses in my lifetime, it's a lot more... against you than it seems like it used to be in the days of my mom and dad.
Well, you know, it's never been easy. You know, when we look back on what our parents and grandparents went through, you think, well, gee, it was so much easier, or you know, stuff was less expensive. But at the time when
it's all relative.
Yeah. At the time that they were living it, they didn't say, gee, this is easy.
Right.
It's going to be tough. You know, So you know, I certainly appreciate your and respect your knowledge and your experience there. But I'm sure you'd agree that it's never been easy. You have to work at it and work at it and work at it some more.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Eric.
Successful implementation is the foundation.
Eric, are you there? Okay, then let's go to Columbia, Maryland. Ronnie, it's your turn.
Hello, and welcome back, Diane.
Thank you.
I happen to be from Perth Amboy, New Jersey, and
right.
I'm Ronnie Goss Berkowitz. So
well, hi, Ronnie.
My brother graduated with Robert.
Absolutely, Bruce Goss.
And my parents had a mom and pop operation. I wouldn't call it a store because they had a milk business, not particularly successful. However, Robert's parents were my parents' customers.
That's right.
But one of the things that I remember so vividly from it and has been so important in my life are the life experiences that I learned from my parents and especially my father. You know, I used to go I helped him deliver milk as I got older during school vacations. And I used to see how he interacted with the with his customers. He had some Puerto Rican customers. Puerto Ricans were our minority group in Perth Amboy, as Robert will remember, mm-hmm. and not always treated so well. Well, my father had a storekeeper, another mom-and-pop operation. Mr. Tirado had a store on State Street, and he needed a car, to borrow a car for a driver's license. My father very graciously said, of course, use my car. He had Polish Catholic customers who loved my father. And remember, my father also was an immigrant from Russia who had some pretty difficult experiences with pogroms, but never held that against any of his of the people in our community who happened to have come from the same Yeah, and in fact, when my grandmother was dying, one of his customers made a novena for my grandmother. And I those are the experiences that I, as a social worker, have brought into my professional life as far as learning the value of everybody's ethnicity, everyone's traditions, and I think I learned that so much from my father.
Ronnie, that's such a wonderful way for us to end this program, thinking about the experiences that one has growing up with an example like that. Here is a last note. Thanks to Mr. Spector for reminding us that small is really very good.
That's lovely.
And the book we've been talking about is titled The Mom and Pop Store. Robert Spector is the author. Thanks for being here. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you, Diane. I have too.
And thanks for listening. All back with you tomorrow. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.